Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are back talking about the state of the Irish media and the state of you, Martin McMahon. How are you, buddy?
I'm grand, and I'm still crying about that piece you had in the, was it the Irish Times there? I really signed up as a patron. Oh. Now, just in case you do want to sign up as a patron, please go to our website, tortoiseshack.ie. The links are there. We need patrons to put podcasts out.
Would you stop?
It was the Irish Times that published it, though. I think you should sign up to the Irish Times patron.
With further ado, he's introduced himself. New hack with the Irish Times himself. Old hack with the Sunday Business Post and previously of the Journal.ie. Jack Horgan-Jones. Jack, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm not too bad. Delighted to be here, making my debut.
Our paths have crossed several times down through the years, and even in your previous roles and all the rest of it. And it is fair to say that, you know, that is kind of the career path, isn't it? In a way, you know, you've started off in the Journal, you've moved to the Sunday Business Post, all of which do great work. Now you're in the Irish Times. I suppose it's only fair to say, because we spoke with the Patreon model, we opened with the Patreon model, we do obviously rely on people to put their hands in their pockets. Irish media needs people to pay. There's a value to what it's done. You know, I think some of the work you guys do is fantastic. I no problem paying for it. How have you seen that evolution over the last few years?
Yeah, I think there's an awful lot of cynicism and kind of fatalism around media in general, and there's plenty of reasons to be uncheerful. But I also think that, you know, you can be heartened by a lot of the flight to quality dynamics that have taken place in the last maybe couple of years. I mean, you can roughly take the Trump thing and the traffic that he drove to the New York Times subscription model as, you know, maybe the turning point in this, but people realizing, you know, that there was a difference between the information that you got for free and the information that you paid for, but, you know, someone was being paid to produce on a professional level. So I think increasingly people are willing to part with their hard-earned cash in order to support journalism. So I think that in general is a good thing.
There was a recent survey that showed that actually it's the younger generation that are more inclined to pay for it. It's the 25 to 35 year olds, whereas we have the stodgy.
It's all the 50 pluses getting the news on Facebook that are voting for the
album. But isn't that interesting? Because we would have thought the opposite. We would have thought what we called it, the Jagger generation, the guys who had the money would be more inclined to put their hands in their pockets. But it turns out it is actually the people who were told want to just look at their phones all the time. They're more inclined to pay for it.
Yeah, I think that is interesting. And again, it's heartening, you know, the kids are all right. Like. And I think that, you know, why I take heart from the fact that people are paying is not the idea that we can kind of recreate the halcyon age of journalism where you had large national titles paying people great wages and you had public state broadcasters and you had this kind of 20th century high point of professionalized journalism and you had great local media as well. I think that is gone. And what is going to replace that will almost of necessity be inferior in some ways just because it's not as well resourced. But why I'm pleased is that there seems to be a floor on, you know, the death of media. And I think that we will see a new money stream coming into media organizations, which is people who are willing to pay for subscriptions. You know, when you see the New York Times doing it, you see the Economist doing it, you see the FT doing it really well, and the Irish Times doing it really well here as well, whereby the paper is replacing every print reader that's lost with, you know, one point something digital readers and revenue circulation is going up while circulation is going down. So there is going to be a money hose for media to kind of to drink from. It's just not going to be as big as it was before. So then you have to start asking yourself, what do you lose with a smaller revenue stream and what can you sustain and what kind of media sphere will be left with afterwards? I think you'll get a lot of consolidation. But there will be survivors, and they'll just be kind of bigger and have more complex jobs as publishers rather than, you know, straight up newspapers. They'll be kind of cross-platform, and they'll have more diverse audiences and more complex jobs to do. And there'll be, I think, what is most troubling about that, even though it's a positive trend in general, what I think is troubling is that perhaps there'll be a loss of plurality then and a loss of different voices, which is probably where, you know, hopefully podcasts like this come in. You know, people will just come along and there'll be that kind of, you know, grassroots thing going on whereby people will give it a lash and winners will emerge from that and forge together some sort of business model. And
well, I kind of think you're right on that, because we've seen from the guests we've had in here, we do have people who are known, but we've also had a lot of people who weren't known and who have since been here and moved on to, as we say, jokingly, half jokingly say, is the bottom rung of the media ladder. You come in here, there is a good chance you'll be interviewed by somebody else for something else. So yeah, I think that you've seen in voices emerging through the process. Do they need to diversify? Yeah, they can't just be seen as newspapers anymore. They must be something else. Why aren't
the older people buying newspapers? Well, you don't keep money if you spend it. That's why. Yeah, that's the God honest truth, and they know it all.
Yeah, I think what's hard is how those winners will emerge from, you know, the green shoots of podcasting and blogging or whatever. Because people are going to get more price sensitive on that subscription thing that we talked about. I think people are willing to pay, but I think there's probably a limit on what people are willing to pay. There's a lot of people now, you know, setting out and saying, well, sure, I can charge people, you know, 12 quid a month or 15 quid a month, because that's really damn all, you know, in the grand scheme of things. But people are going to be looking at their outgoings every month, and they have a podcast or they have a couple of Patreons, they have an Irish Times subscription, you know, they might have an FT subscription, they might have a Netflix and Spotify, and all of a sudden you're north of 100 quid and you're edging towards 120, 150, and people will start looking for...
They're creating it. Like, I can tell you, as someone who tries to manage a Patreon account, Martin will tell you that the biggest... regret of mine was to turn around to the guys a few months ago and tell them that we thought we were about to break even for the first time. And I said to them, lads, we're, after 18 months of this, you'll be able to buy yourself a pizza this month or whatever it was. And I think it was literally that amount of money. Like, you know, go out and treat yourselves to a pizza. And then I had to ring them back and say, what actually happened is, 32 people had gone in and either reduced their amount they were paying or just deleted it altogether. And I went, I'm sorry, but there's no money there. And people are, so if you're not even,
you'll see that as well the next time the economy slows down.
Yes, absolutely.
You'll see that in people's, you know, optional subscriptions, but you'll also see it in traditional media that haven't grown that other revenue stream, that are still totally reliant on like print advertising income. Because at the moment, print advertising income will keep you afloat to a certain extent. There's still advertising budget for print within advertising budgets. But when the economy slows down, when the macro picture slows down, I think that'll be the first thing to go, because it's so hard to measure and it's so expensive. And unless you've built yourself alternative revenue streams around subscriptions, then I think you're goose. And that's where you're going to see a lot of, I think, local media perhaps go to the wall, because they just, like, you know, they've been firefighting for the last 10, 15 years. They haven't had a chance to build up these, like, you know, events businesses or whatever else might keep the wolf from the door, you know. That's when you might get a lot of examinerships, a lot of receiverships in media, and you might get a moment of kind of consolidation as well. You might get INM come in and mop stuff up. You might get the Irish Times. You might get some other kind of, like, you know, a media who's type, you know, overseas player come in and mop up. And, you know, the hope would be that they can retain those titles in circulation and retain a focus on good journalism as opposed to just...
But there's great journalism out there.
There's fantastic journalism.
That's it. I always take this, but we never, myself and Martin, we're supposed to be the guys who maybe rail against it, but we meet great people who do great work, who deliver great journalism all the time. And, you know, I just wish...
I think the news pages in Irish newspapers are doing really well. I think fantastic news journalists working today.
When you stray into the opinion pages, that things start to fall.
You might say that. I couldn't possibly comment. But I think there's a point there as well. And to bring it back to the Trump thing, right? Afterwards, there was all this kind of self-flagellation in media. Is like, you know, how did we miss the Trump phenomenon coming? How did we not see the Rust Belt states going? And I think people were talking about commentators as opposed to news journalists. They were talking about people who misdiagnosed, you know, the Trump phenomenon. But it wasn't news journalists. I mean, all the big stories that made a difference or nearly made a difference during that presidential campaign, nearly all of them emerged from traditional publishers and journalists. You know, the Access Hollywood tape, it was the Washington Post that broke that story. You know, people were doing really good beat journalism on that campaign trail. And people are doing really good beat journalism now, which I think they should be applauded for, because their resources are more straightened. You have to do literally more in terms of word count and output. You get less time to do it, and you have to work across different forums. So, like, you know, honestly, they're like I'm in awe of a lot of the colleagues that I work with in the media space, because they do stuff at a really high quality. And I know, and it's not popular to say, because people tend to focus on the failings of media, which are multiple and very public. But I would argue that, you know, if you compare media and journalism, including in Ireland, to a lot of other industries, I'd say we come up pretty well. And we also, we are pretty harsh on ourselves and on each other when we let the side down as well.
That would be where I would differ in my I'd come back onto you on that. Now, when you do have a critique of media, sometimes when they circle the wagons, I find it's unfair that you have to understand that yes, absolutely, sometimes we are getting this wrong. And you know, I know great journalists who have actually done me the privilege of coming at me when I said something that was, you know, that I formed an opinion on something, and they've corrected me, and I've said, yeah, that's grand. It's okay to be wrong. And I have found that there are issues where it's like, well, trying to get a correction, trying to get a things. It's like, oh, well, now send a letter into the editor. We'll run that. I do think some of that, there needs to be a little bit more introspection as well, because we see these reports that time and time again tell us that trust in the media is down. And again, I don't know necessarily.
One of our previous guests in here had done a thesis on how austerity was portrayed in the media. And without fail, the big, all big media, all big newsprint, all big media,
as a necessary evil, that kind of thing. Had, you know, this had must be done, we must put our show.
Yes,
they had, you come back to the whole Chomsky manufacturing consent.
Yes, it was a manufacturing.
Sorry, not for one second am I suggesting that media is perfect.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that Irish media, given the circumstances in particular, does a much better job than it's given credit for.
I think we have, as, and I'll echo what Tony says, we have great reporters doing great stories. There are some really great stories out there. There's a lot of competition in the market. There are so many stories vying for supremacy within the media. And every now and again, something does break through. Mm. And it takes, like we'll say, for instance, say the guilty verdict in that trial. Mm. That is the discussion of media without fail, right across the board. Mm. And rightly so. That's the discussion today. Mm. But most days, it's competing stories. Nothing's ever taking a head and shoulders above everything else. And there are journalists really grubbing those stories. And I mean, you call it foot journalism, but they are grubbing, grinding those stories out day in, day out. And we've seen new models come on board.
Well, no, Martin, sorry, can I come in? I just think, what I'm saying is there's a difference between the guy who's out there burning shoe leather or working the phones and working away, and that's terrific work. It's really important, and it actually informs the public. When people say, we talk about the cliche of like, oh, when will I go? I didn't hear about that, and then you're going, well, we ran that story 2 weeks ago, or we, you know, it maybe didn't get in the zeitgeist. What we have, though, unfortunately, and maybe it relates to the first point around the income model, is we also have let's have a contrarian write an op-ed or something that's designed to actually generate that, I don't know, what do you want to call them, anger?
Do you ever think, though, I mean, like, I take that point, but do you ever think that sometimes there's an expectation, maybe you have it, maybe you don't, but that your views should be replicated in their entirety on the opinion pages, and that when they're not your views or views of people like you, politically, then, you know, this is someone just attempting, you know, lazy clickbait, you know, alarmist journalism or commentary, and, you know, maybe it's not, maybe it's someone looking to invite a plurality of voices in.
Absolutely, I agree with that. That we have to, like, not. It's like, who do you vote for politically? There's a plethora of people out there. You have to represent all voices. I agree with that. I do think we obviously, but I do think some of it's tired. Some of it is jaded. Some of it is unnecessary. We don't need to re-debate some of the things that are already been tested and then tried and found to be, look, that's not actually factually correct just because it's a hot take or it's going to be give, you know, and we're guilty of it ourselves on social media. We're guilty of it. And we do want.
Like, often as well, like, and to agree with you, like, I mean, the people who might run an opinion page, like, you know, they are of a certain generation and they're usually kind of white older men, straight white older men. And, you know, when they try in good faith, you know, to find a voice to represent a movement that is very unfamiliar to them, you know, something like the repeal movement or something, you know, like the fracturing in politics that's going on at the moment, sometimes they can just make a mistake. And they just pick the wrong guy or girl.
Absolutely. And it's okay to be wrong.
And you just misjudge it.
And we're always wrong. We're always learning. We're always on that. Like this idea of, you know, whatever you want to call it, cancel culture. You want to talk. I'm not for that at all. I'm not for that sort of stuff. But what I am for is if you want to talk about plurality, you need to actually have a diversity of voices. It would be nice to see more females. It would be nice to see more, people of color.
Yeah. And I think that's absolutely right. And I think that it's beholden on the media themselves to try and reach those new communities and include those viewpoints first person, you know, in the media. Because for too long, media has reflected the views of the people who work in it, who traditionally have been like me. And that can be really discouraging for, you know, people who might be of the new Irish generation coming up through, they're doing their leaving certs now, you know, and entering into university, and, you know, they go and they might do a placement in a newsroom and see, you know, that these people don't look like me, these people don't sound like me. And whenever I'm talking to students, I try to say, like, that's exactly why you should be in the media, you know, if you look around and see people who aren't like you. We need you more than you need us, so please stick with it, you know. And I think the media, and particularly larger publishers like the IT or RTE, have a duty, if you're well resourced and you have the time and space to be strategic about what you do, to go off and kind of, you know, craft these outreach programs. I know the Guardian does stuff like this as well, you know, because otherwise you end up becoming relevant, you know, or you risk ending up becoming irrelevant. You don't reflect.
If you get it wrong, you ultimately become irrelevant. If you get it wrong, you do ultimately. Again, I think after that recent report that it's younger people paying for media, I think you will probably see a shift towards catering towards younger people more. It makes sense. It just makes sense. If they're your market, go after your market.
Yeah.
So you may see some of the, and I think it's only right that older voices get phased out, or, you know, 30 years writing the same article, it's long enough, move on, do something else.
I think it's sad when there's an unwillingness for that older generation to kind of shuffle off the stage, you know, and because
now, I'm not being ageist or sexist, or I would consider myself, you know, within an arm's reach of that older demographic, and, you know, as white middle-aged men, I am fed up reading white middle-aged men. They're not interesting.
But, like, there is something kind of troubling, and it's hard to articulate exactly why, but, like, when you realise that for literally not just my entire adult life, but for my entire kind of conscious life, you've been seeing a lot of the same people reading the news, you know?
But it gets even more intriguing for my entire adult life, and the Kenny was a politician. I mean, for my entire, and I'm not young, for my entire life, I saw that man's picture. For my entire life. You know, and politics and news are so intertwined. They are so intertwined. You know, sometimes it's just time to shovel off and let another voice in
there. We have seen that, and it's broadening it out. We have actually seen the success of that in things like the climate strike and these other movements where, as has been said to me, they just want to see, to stand beside the young people as opposed to hold them back now. And that actually starting to, I'm starting to see that filter through in media as well.
You know, I have a certain cynicism about all of that. I've seen all this before. I've seen, well, the young people are going to save.
I'm shocked you're cynical.
They don't. They become older and they become more cynical and they become less active. Mm. And that's what happens. So, you know, at 16 years of age, we're all gung-ho. I remember being CND and, you know, it was all there before. This is nothing new. This is simply
a repeat. I hope they don't, because, I mean, this is not just your common garden political center of gravity, the climate change thing. Like, I mean, you know, you either get this right now for that generation and respond, or else you're goosed. Do you know what I mean?
Like, I am gung ho. We need to do something. I'm also terribly cynical in that politics moves very, very slowly.
Mm.
And, you know, somewhere in the back room, there's some guy going, oh, we have two choices. We can either fix the planet we're on or find a new one. Mm. And I think that in reality, whilst they might talk about fixing the planet they're on, politics is about looking for a new planet. You know, mm. It really is.
Yeah, because the political costs, and I think that's something that we're seeing, I don't know when this is going out, but the climate action plan was published yesterday.
Mm.
The political costs of addressing climate change are substantial.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, there is a large political disincentive not to do it. So it'll take an act of singular political courage to actually go after this, because people are going to have to fundamentally change their lifestyles. People, individuals and firms and companies are going to have to be penalised for behaviours which have effectively been implicitly or explicitly encouraged for generations.
Some of them receive incentives to do the things that are actually, and we need to, like, 500 million a year that we're paying in subsidies to some of these companies that we now need to roll back on and say, not only are we not going to pay your subsidies, we want to penalise you for these practices.
And the problem is there's a lot of livelihoods and a lot of ordinary livelihoods invested in that situation. So, like, you know, there's always been this kind of never attitude towards climate change that, you know, we have a plan, we have a notional plan, and also there will be green jobs.
Yeah.
People will retool and then they just kind of reskill and then everyone starts kind of mumbling. At some point in the future. Anyway, back to burning carbon. Yeah. So, like, but now the point is that, like, there's a political groundswell in favour of actually doing something about this. There is a meteorological inevitability about what's going on as well. So they have to, if they have any gumption at all, make those difficult political choices. And the question is, you know, whether the current leadership of Ireland, Europe and the world is the right one to do it, or whether we even have a political system that is flexible enough to accommodate that. You look at the Gilets Jaunes thing.
Or an economic system that can take it. Transition costs. Transition is pain. It's about who's going to suffer the pain most. And in a neoliberal system where we're relying on ultra-capitalism to fuel economies, to keep countries developing, it's not going to work.
Well, you can't have Leo Varadkar sitting and pledging tax breaks if he's re-elected over the course of the next 3 years, and then square that circle with the fact that this costs a whole lot of money, and we need to keep these. And they're obsessed with keeping our debt to GDP ratio in check. If you want to do these things,
they're not that obsessed. If you ask the Irish Fiscal Advisor,
a very good point. But only on certain things where we've had these things where they've absolutely.
But I think even on a bigger scale,
Seamus Coffey has said their plan is not credible, and he's saying that from a numbers point of view. But then if you're saying, when you look at the plan that came out on the actual climate action plan, the only money raising exercise in it currently is the carbon tax,
which is kind of one of the muddier aspects of what they haven't really articulated, and they've kind of said, oh, you know, budget day, it's a budget day measure
between now and 2030, and, you know, it's kind of on the never, and we'll ramp it up, and sure we'll put it where it is. And you're going, well, you know, I spoke to Cara Ostenberg from UCD yesterday, and she was saying, like, you know, there's 41 recommendations in the Oireachtas Climate Action Report. Like to see them. Let's not just talk about climate, carbon tax.
The thing that has unsettled me to some degree about the climate package, which was the over reliance on electric vehicles. And stuff like that. Like there's a lot of
you're not
noise
gonna phase
around
out
that.
You're not going to phase
and
out.
Like, of course, electric vehicles are a good idea, but like, I mean, electric vehicles are at the core of the previous climate plans because they're kind of visible and easy to understand that, you know, you switch to electric vehicles. But like, it's a very small part of a very large solution.
Jack,
like,
so everyone
worrying about switching to electric vehicles is kind of missing the point.
Three hybrid buses a few months after they bought 200 diesel buses. Mm. I mean, that sort of stuff, the public know these things now. They can't hide that. And it goes, well, if you're not doing it, why am I going to be forced into an electric car? And I'm all for electric. I'm for retrofitting of houses. I'm for doing all of these things. But there's a price to that.
You know what kind of annoys me, actually, is like my first job in journalism was in the rather unglamorous salt mines of the trade magazines. I wrote about renewable energy. And I actually loved it. It was a really interesting job. And this was kind of back in 2012-ish, and there was a lot of wind farms being built. And I was like, where do all these wind turbines get made? And it's all Denmark and Germany. Because back in the late 80s and early 90s, they built the early stages of a kind of, you know, research-led, subsidy-driven industry. And you fast forward 20 or 30 years, and not only are they weaning their electricity systems off carbon-based fuels, they're also doing it with their own kit and exporting that to us.
Selling.
And then, I turn around and I say, but like, sure, we're even windier than Germany and Denmark. You know? like we have the raw materials. And it's happening again to a certain extent with wave and tidal. Like, I mean, we are on the western edge of Europe. We have these enormous waves rolling in off the Atlantic every day. And it's an incredibly difficult and complex engineering challenge to get systems built that can extract that and turn that kinetic energy into grid energy. But like, you know, we don't seem to be backing that in any real way. You know, we don't seem to be trying to create an industry around
that.
You know,
company that shot up in Mayo is now based out of Scotland.
I can't remember the name of them, but in Scotland, and I think the Scottish government made it a big core part of their industrial policy to try and be leaders in renewable energy.
But it was an Irish company
that
was told there's no future for you in Ireland, and they just said, and the Scottish government came along and said, well actually we will subsidise you until you're.
And it is a really expensive thing, and it is a bit of a punt, you know. Like, I mean, these are, as I say, technologically very challenging things, but like, you know, wouldn't it be fantastic if, you know, not only we like paid lip service to this idea of becoming leaders in renewable energy and stuff like that, but actually went for it and actually said, right, no, we want like an industry here that manufactures these things and employs people in well-paying, like old style manufacturing engineering jobs, you know, and is an export boon to the economy as well, as opposed to just kind of like, you know, relying on multinationals.
I say it about all economies. If you're not making something, you don't really have an economy. If you're not making, if there's not some manufacturing somewhere in your economy, you don't really have one. You might buy in FDI, you might entice them in, but you've no indigenous manufacturing base that when all goes tits up, you have something to fall back on.
Yeah, and the overexposure of like, you know, the Irish industrial model to overseas capital is really worrying.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's not a political statement.
You don't
have to be left or center to say that. That's just, you know, that's empirically the case.
We have four companies equating for nearly 50% of our corporation tax take. I mean, it is astronomical. I mean, the Fiscal Advisory Council, who we've referenced already, they've warned against this now 2 years running, and we're not weaning ourselves off that currently.
And there doesn't seem to be anything kind of coming up to potentially replace that, you know?
Well,
we have indigenous multinationals to a certain extent, and the likes of kind of Kerry Group, Lambia, Ryanair, you know? But like, outside of pockets of employment, they're not massive, massive employers, you know?
And we are at the highest employment rate ever in the state. And it's worth saying that we are at the highest employment rate ever in the state. And yet we still have 10,000 homeless people. We still have 500,000 people waiting to see a consultant. So if things are so good, why are things so bad?
Well, yeah. And then you get back to that kind of dual speed economy thing that Aidan Regan has talked about a lot. And he's almost certainly someone that you've had in this podcast.
Yeah, we have. Yeah.
Probably a few times.
Yeah. Desperately handsome.
You know,
Desperately handsome. He annoys me so handsome.
But he's made this point that, you know, there could be a decoupling effect going on in the Irish economy between the kind of light speed standard of living, extremely well paid FDI jobs in Dublin. You know, you live in Capital Dock or something like that, and you're effectively price insensitive to things like housing and healthcare because your company pays for them.
Yes.
Pays for them anyway, and then everyone else, you know. And a lot of my friends now work in the multinational sector, you know, and they do better than I could possibly imagine or hope to do. So
the government's reply to the EU Leilani
Farah's report on housing.
The reply to that is actually
this is the five pager that went out in the journal.
You know, there isn't a. It was what you've just said in that there's a two-tier economy. What they basically said was, well, there isn't a problem with rentals unless you're poor, relying on the private market.
Well, it didn't reference once, Martin, the homelessness numbers. Just ignored it, as if that wasn't happening.
It basically said, look, we have a top tier that's doing quite well, so there isn't a problem with the private housing.
Can I take that back further to when Leilani issued it? We've spoken to Leilani couple of times now, but when she wrote the initial reply, I do recall a thread on Twitter getting picked up by and becoming a news story because the reply was from the Minister for Finance's advisor, Ed Brophy, and Ed said, well, the flow of it, she talks about financialization, but surely the flow of capital, foreign capital, is because of the strength of our economy. And you go, well, if you're going to read it from that perspective, and one person is saying it's actually one of the things that's driving the government's own report, said puts us at risk of socioeconomic apartheid. That's in their own report.
Is this the Department of Finance one on
it? Yes, exactly. And that report said because of high electoral divisions, where you say areas of Tala, where you have 53% of all beds available are owned by institutional landlords, and that was what they called.
We see again, like, in principle, I don't really have a problem with institutional landlords.
No, but
I think, you know, a well-run institutional sector is probably preferable in some ways to the kind of weird little investment asset class for mom and pop when they retire from the guards with a lump sum, you know, and then you get very amateurish, very low standards of kind of landlordism.
But
if they are able to do it well, I don't see a problem with it. I see a problem with it when they don't do it well, or when they're seen as the only solution to a housing crisis. Just, you know, let's bring down the barriers and bring in institutional landlords. They'll solve it eventually.
Big pushback on that is the fact that in other countries where that does it well, and there are many that do it well in terms of they can rent for life. They will have rent certainty. They will have security of tenure. We don't have those things. We're colouring around the edges on them, and now we're saying, oh, we'll look at those things, but I don't want to scare the big institutional landlords.
No, you're dead right. And that comes back to one of the problems with the Irish relationship with housing is that it's not ever been the case that, you know, your house is just the roof over your head. It's also your asset. And, you know, the idea now that people will be happy to rent at a very high level, you know, because there's some kind of weird, poorly formed idea of millennials as wanting to be kind of footloose and fancy free. Yeah, it's like, that's bollocks.
Of course it is.
It's total bollocks. Like, I mean, millennials, I'm a millennial, you know, I'm 32. Millennials want what everyone else want. They want, like, you know, secure housing where they can have families and grow up in and have a degree of security going forward.
But if you think of it, it's the capitalist wet dream. You have one or two generations, very highly paid. No chance of ever owning a home. No chance of ever having that asset. So everything they have is disposable. Everything they have. So you can mine them for rent. You can mine them for transport. You can mine. And at the end of the day, these people die. And if they have enough money to cover their funeral, great, they're in the ground. But they leave nothing
behind. It's kind of like how The Matrix uses people.
But they leave nothing behind them.
Don't give them any ideas.
But the one key indicator of generation wealth, or the one key driver of generational wealth, is home ownership.
Yeah, it's your gap. Yeah, exactly. And that's what's really problematic as well. When you're playing in a system that has extremely high levels of rent just to participate.
Yeah.
Because, like, and extremely low security of tenure. Because even let's say, you know, lived in a market that was more functional and you had an affordable level of rent, you would have that chunk of income and you might you might invest that in like an exchange traded fund or something like that, or put it into your pension. You know, you will be retaining something for the future. But like, if you live in a world where you have to pay 1,600, 1,700, 1,800 more, you know, while wage growth, while it is appreciating, is not appreciating at the same rate.
You're a walking ATM for a capitalist class.
When you retire, you're really goosed because your income will drop off, and your housing costs won't, and you have no asset.
You've worked in the Sunday Business Post. You've done some great stuff in terms of the markets and business, and that's not just saying because you're here, but you have you've written a great piece for the Irish Times, a long form piece about housing. You get the granularity of it.
I'm not going to disagree.
No, but like when you look at that and you take it and you take that to one side and then you say, well, when we're doing this, is it right that the policies that we are still pursuing seem to be, I have to say, they seem to be actually made up to still encourage the thing that hasn't worked for the last decade. And no, last two decades, actually, if we're telling the truth, because we built up pre-Celtic Tiger, post crash, and now we're saying where we're seeing, and the mood music has changed. And this is to get to my point, is a really long winded way of saying
it.
They are starting to say that the housing market, because wages are now rising at a similar level to house prices, that everything is okay, but they're ignoring the fact that rents continue to rise well above wages. That is not actually that. That should be a red flag.
Yeah, there's a couple of things going on. I think that, so effectively your point is kind of, why do we keep doing things the same? You know, like I throw it back to what we were talking about when it comes to climate change. You know, like if you've always done stuff one way, people have become invested in that system perpetuating itself. They figured out how to do well out of it, and changing that just because it's, you know, a good idea from a policy point of view politically can be really difficult. And there was something else that I wanted to say, but I forgot it.
But I will say there's great hope today in that bond today. I don't know if you saw that. There's a 5-year rent freeze now in the city of Bonn. That puts pressure on other European cities to follow suit, including Dublin. And a 5-year rent freeze in Dublin.
I think something must be done, right? Something does have to happen because, like, and I remember the other thing I wanted to say now, because if you look at the political effects of this, right, they're not insignificant, I think, going forward, because you will have that cohort of people who are now entering into, you know, proper adulthood, you know, beyond the age of 25. And they're looking at the system, whatever this amorphous thing is that we call the system, and saying, what are you providing for me? Like, you're providing, like, a less secure, less wealthy, unhappier future potentially, or probably not even potentially, than my parents had.
Yes.
Why should I support this? You know, and that's like when politics starts to reorganize itself in quite volatile ways, and you get things like, you know, Jean, emergence of the alt-right, all that kind of stuff. People become disinvested in, you know, in society, and, you know, that can be a good process sometimes, you know. It can be a really, really.
I disagree with you that they become disinterested. They are deliberately excluded. I mean, there is a certain anybody who is not earning 80k plus in Ireland, because that's the basic entry level for buying a house in Ireland now at the moment is 80k. That's what you got to be earning. If you're not on that level, you're a victim. You're an absolute victim. You are being absolutely mined all the way down the line for everything, not just for housing, single thing down the line.
I'd kick back and say, I wouldn't say you're a victim. I'd say, look, myself and Jack, what there's 8 years between us. Do I think I have by any sitting in my house and we're recording this purely on
fancy,
the basis,
fancy banker's house,
but that we can laugh about it. But the fact is, I came out of college, I did my things, and the world was set up for me. And I see, and you're right to point out that this will be the first generation in 100 years that is worse off than their parents' generation, and it's your generation.
Yeah, well, there's a really profound expression of that, like I did my Leaving Cert in 2005, right? I mean, peak Celtic Tiger, you know, absolute, like, helicopters down to the Galway race.
I was probably
you were probably in the helicopter
off the Glen Eagles for the weekend and all the rest of it.
And then by the time I finished my undergrad in 2008, it had gone. It collapsed. It was the most dramatic reversal, you know. So I think that, like, that whole generation that you know, were in their late teens during the heyday of the Celtic Tiger, like, you know, they were told that, you know, you are the Silver Spoon generation, things are going to be set up for you. And they're finding adult life to be significantly more complex and difficult than they possibly could have imagined. And they're kind of like, you know.
But there's also an absence of an institutionalized memory that at one stage, not so long ago, and it's really not so long ago, is that one adult, one parent in a house with a decent wage could support another adult in the house, children, drive a car, pay the mortgage. And how has the world changed so dramatically?
That you need basically two people working all the hours that are available for work to
just
support.
Just to rent.
Yeah.
You know, it's a radical change that has happened extremely fast, and home ownership has dropped by 1% a year over the last 14 years.
Which, again, in principle, is not necessarily problematic. It's the system is not set up.
Our entire system, your old age, your retirement, everything is predicated on owning a home.
Yeah.
Now, we've changed.
So, and that comes back to the point I was making about, like, you know, hiding behind this, like, oh, lifestyles are changing, you know.
Lifestyles are changing.
How do you know that? People are finding it more challenging to access the standard of living, which is going to keep them happy and keep the presented together. That's what's happening.
And that is where the polarization comes. Yeah. And it's not that Australian economists said, well, they want to stop eating avocado toast or Carl Dieter saying they like this flexibility. It's like, nah, you know.
Maybe some people do, but I'd say in your early 20s, yeah, absolutely. But this is the thing that I was saying, like, millennials and the generation behind millennials, like, they don't want something that's radically different. They want the same thing everyone else wants.
And it is less. Why would you ever want... And, you know, when people are trying to sell you this point, it's always anecdotal. Hmm. How do you know? Well, my cousin in San Francisco says his friend loves this.
Yeah.
Well, that's not actually evidence that anybody... You know, we are...
It is actually... And usually the people who advance that are pretty good with data, you know. It's kind of flimsy assertion. They should be challenged. They should be said. It should be put to them. You know, support that with the data. I think it's an interesting data point that same generation are now beginning to pay for news because maybe they realize something's up and they want to get informed about it.
Yeah, politics for people who aren't interested in politics is like people who are drowning who aren't interested in water.
Mm.
You know, sooner or later it becomes relevant to you. And it may be just becoming more relevant earlier now because, like, at 25, you're done, you're finished. No house, no future.
Which brings us to that question of what has actually happened in terms of the last while in Ireland. As you said, Martin, the economy is flying. More people at work than ever, any time in the history of state. Biggest tax take in the history of the state. Obviously, social crises when it comes to housing, health, even our education system. You know, our third level education system doesn't get enough coverage. It's creaking at the seams.
The problem there seems to be that people just, and I'm by no means an expert in education policy, but like nobody seems to be willing to make a decision on how we're going to fund this going forward.
Mm.
Like it was gutted during the recession and nobody, so what you have is this kind of creeping, team where, you know, there's a onus on people to commercialize their research and that happens in an unstructured way. Again, not necessarily a bad thing in principle, but like when it becomes the be all and end all and does so in an unstructured way because it's the only way to keep the wolf from the door financing wise, that's problematic. And, you know, I think have they even made a decision on the Casals report
not that I'm aware of. And when you look at those things and you meet, like, I interviewed a terrific economist the other day who did his whole PhD on cooperatives and how they operate and how they operate successfully in Italy, and in one of the cities in Italy it has the highest standard of living in the entire country, and he's off to Nova Scotia next week because he cannot get steady work here. And, you know, that sector is really suffering. But when you broaden that out and you say you want to square the circle, we don't have a political vision. And this goes back to the point again around climate, around all of those things. We need to bring people with us. We talk about fighting with people. We talk about being adversarial, all of our stuff. If you want actually to give something, you need to give them something to aim for. For my money, whether it's left, right, or the centrists, no one is putting up the Saints. And well, actually, I wonder if,
and again, you know, amateur when it comes to political science, like, but I wonder to what extent is that enforced by Irish political culture always being ultimately pragmatic and not really having any organizing principles beyond getting elected. Do you know what I mean? And that's why Fianna Fáil were so successful, because like they roughed, like, I mean, they did a little bit of social democracy. They did a little bit of kind of liberalism. Like, you know, they did whatever worked, you know? So,
well, there is a counter argument that there is a lot of wealth accumulated in the older generation.
Mm.
This is true. This is true. I've read this. There's a lot of wealth accumulated in the older generation. When they die, they pass it on to the millennials now who don't have houses.
Mm.
And that the long-term vision is, well, don't worry about it because they'll inherit the money anyway. And that's the long-term, is that you don't have, they will eventually get houses, but only after their parents have popped off.
Well, yeah. And then like,
but you can,
on top of that being slightly grim, it's true.
It is true.
And then you have like complicating social factors. Like, I mean, if you're only going to have access to property when, you know, your folks die.
Yep.
Or you shove them off to a home, like, or I mean, and then you
take an iceberg.
Yeah. Or take a trip to Dignitas, maybe if they're proven particularly stubborn. Like, and then you match that with increased longevity and stuff like that. And then you have a situation whereby people are just literally, it's kind of like, you know,
you're sitting there with your knife,
like the ginger man, you know, you're waiting around for your parents to die so you can live, like, and live in a home and stuff like that. And that's not good from a kind of social point of view.
Dystopian. Yeah. And it is the ultimate, it's the end run of, like, it's late stage capitalism is what it is.
It's just grim. Like, imagine living with your folks for that long.
But that's where it's heading. The only chance you're ever going to get as a 25-year-old right now to own your own house is when mom and dad pop the clocks. There you go. That's the only chance you're going to have.
Yeah, or you work for Google and Facebook.
Just last thing for me, and I mean, again, we can, just to bring it back to the future of media, I want to talk about. There is, as I keep going back to it, there's terrific work being done. But you did, I'm a bit afraid about the number of platforms available.
Mm.
We're sitting on one, we're using one, but for some, you know, and we're lucky enough and we are very grateful to have an audience. But it's getting to that point now where we actually can, you see in the UK something like Novaris where they have that. Does Ireland have potential for things like that, in your opinion?
I think they do. I think it's slightly complicated by the size of the market. Like, it's much easier to launch your dedicated niche subscription news website for whatever niche you're trying to service in a market where, you know, there's tens of hundreds or
50 million people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or like if you're doing something like the Second Captains, where your niche product is actually not that niche, it's sport. Everyone loves sport, you know, and they're doing it really well and doing it in a way that is appealing to new audiences. It's much more difficult, much more challenging for Ireland. But I mean, there are examples of these new platforms emerging, professional ones in other similar sized markets like the Netherlands. I think there's is it De Information or something like that.
Yeah,
they have a subscription model and they're doing well. Like, there will be winners from this. It's just, it's complicated because you have to get your marketing right, you have to get your product really right, which is the journalism, and then you have to get the fact that people are going to be more price sensitive. So you have to get your price point absolutely dead right. Once you do that, and once you get a reasonably predictable revenue stream, and you can tell your churn rate and everything like that, you can tell how many people are going to be cancelling and subscribing in a given week, you can plan and you can start investing in journalism.
Yeah.
You know, so I hope that that's possible in Ireland, and I hope that people end up doing it, you know.
Well, I hope that we'll see you into the future, Jack. I hope that as time goes on, and we know you're a very busy man at the moment, extremely busy, more out of home, out of work than in work. And congratulations.
Thanks.
I hope everything's going grand there for you.
You better explain what you're referencing.
Jack is a new father.
I am,
10 months old father, yes. to a young girl.
Yeah, indeed.
And,
yeah.
As we all know who've been in that situation, it's the best time in your life. You get no sleep, but it is honestly the best time in your life.
That's the crack.
And you look back on it in years to come and you go, oh, I wish there was still that. So you just do.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks. Thanks. I really enjoyed that. I
appreciate that, Jack. Thanks for your time. Listen, folks, I know we keep saying it, but do head over on the Patreon, hit us up on the, give us the price of a cup of coffee. I'm hoping to buy Martin a pizza some stage this summer.
Yeah, I need pizza like a hob in the head.
Yeah. We get you the gluten-free option, honey. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.